Hello, listeners. It is January 26th, 2017. I'm Scott Bland, and welcome to the Politico Nerdcast. We have a packed agenda for you on today's episode. New policy is flying out of the new White House. The Senate is practically drowning in Trump administration appointees right now, and Democrats are desperately trying to make sense of it all. We would love to have you subscribe, rate us, or even write a written review of the Nerdcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And please send us your questions. We have one this week. So if you'd like your question answered on the Nerdcast in the future, please email us at nerdcast@politico.com. All right, here are the numbers that mattered this week. And the numbers that will be driving the news for probably the next month, too. We'll start with three. That is the number of finalists on President Donald Trump's shortlist for the vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll dig into who they are and preview what's to come in that confirmation fight. Next number, 3 to 5 million. That's the number of illegal votes that Trump said he believes were cast in 2016. More important, he cares enough to be talking about it and some other distractions a lot in the first week of his presidency. And our final data point this week, the number 11. And if you've seen the movie Spinal Tap, you'll understand why we're using this number as a stand-in to talk about what the Democratic Party is going through in exile right now. This is going to be a really great episode. We have a ton to talk about. And here to do it, we have reporter Nancy Cook. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me, Scott.
National political reporter Eliana Johnson.
Hey, Scott.
Chief investigative reporter Ken Vogel.
Excited to be here.
And senior politics editor Charlie Mutessian.
I'm even more excited to be here.
The
Philly gang back with a vengeance this week. All right, let's jump right into segment one. Our first data point of this week is three, and that comes from that's the answer to a question from Amy Rosenthal, one of our listeners, who asked, who do you think Trump will nominate to the Supreme Court, and when is it coming? So we've learned this week that three is the number of finalists on President Donald Trump's shortlist for that Supreme Court vacancy. It's going to be the big story of the next month. Eliana, tell us a little bit about who these three are, how we got to this point, and what could happen next week when we find out who the pick is.
We learned this week that Trump has narrowed his search with the help of the Federalist Society and its executive vice president Leonard Leo.
And Eliana is being humble here. Actually, when she says we learned, she means she learned and scooped this in a story that she will tell us what it says. Sorry to interrupt.
Ken's my PR man sitting here. So, three prominent conservative judges who all sit on circuit courts right now. Bill Pryor, who we had heard a lot about and who Trump named early in the process, who served as Jeff Sessions' deputy when he was back in Alabama. Neil Gorsuch, another circuit judge who seems to be a real favorite of conservatives in the legal world. And Thomas Hardiman, who serves on the Third Circuit with Trump's sister, Marianne Trump Barry. And Politico's Shane Goldmacher reported this morning that Trump's sister has been advocating for his nomination because they are colleagues on the Third Circuit. That's something I've also heard. The two are friends, and Trump obviously weighs the input of his family very heavily. Gorsuch, though, I had people tell me and wrote in our piece that the quality of his writing and the clarity of thinking demonstrated in his opinions really served to elevate him in this process. One conservative sent me an opinion that he wrote coming out against a federal sex offender registry, which is not a popular opinion, but this person thought it really illustrated how he hewed to the principles against popular opinion, constitutional principles, even when it wasn't popular. And so I think that sort of illustrates, this person said to me, these are the sorts of things that help shape the court. And in searching for a replacement for Scalia, that's really what conservatives want. I think this is actually going to be the most mainstream, normal thing Trump does, and tremendously important because a lot of people voted for Trump, or they said, only because they cared so much about who the president would appoint to fill the vacancy created by Scalia's death a year ago.
That's such a good point. Nancy, tell us a little bit more. What are kind of the pros and cons floating around about each of these nominees?
Well, I just want to go back quickly to one thing Eliana said just about conservatives who voted for Trump because of the SCOTUS pick. I mean, I feel like right now we're seeing the schism with Trump and the congressional Republicans, where they're not necessarily agreeing on all policy and Trump is sort of going his own way on certain things. But I do think on the SCOTUS pick, this is going to be the one area where Trump will totally stick to Republican orthodoxy and stick to that list that he came out with in the campaign. And there's a lot of people that really, you know, only got behind him, as Eliana said, because of that, including anti-abortion activists, you know, a lot of Heritage Foundation people, a lot of conservative judicial activists and real conservative groups. And that was a real key element of political support, which was also aided by the addition of Vice President Mike Pence to the ticket that really helped build support for Trump because of that list.
Ken?
And one thing that some of these folks who are sort of cultural conservatives, who for whom the Supreme Court was such an important thing, such an important driver of their support for Trump, have expressed some concerns about, as Ileana revealed in the story that we were talking about, where she revealed the sort of top three is this guy Pryor in a decision that he ruled with the majority on in 2011 to protect transgender people from workplace discrimination, essentially, if I understand it, adding them to the class of protected people who could not be discriminated against in employment decisions. Apparently, that's just lit some of these conservative legal listservs on fire, with people expressing concern about that. It would sort of be, I mean, you know, I think from a liberal perspective, it would be of a piece with what you were suggesting about the other nominees, you know, doing something that was politically unpopular. But I think that's something that at least conservatives, you know, if it's sort of a civil liberties issue where
they could sell it.
Where they could sell it and say, like, oh, this is, you know, the sex offender thing is like excessive, you know, registry is like excessive government regulation, even if it's like seen as being tough on crime. This other decision protecting transgender people from workplace discrimination, you would think same thing, but maybe a little bit harder to sell.
Well, I think the interesting thing about that is that there's a ferocious debate taking place among conservatives in the Federalist Society world. A lot of people are defending him, saying that he joined with the majority opinion. The Supreme Court had a similar ruling, so he was backing what was seen as Supreme Court precedent. And a lot of people saying the decision was wrong. And the conservatives I've spoken to have said it's very difficult to separate some of the criticism of him for that 2011 decision and a lot of evangelical furor over another decision that I think could be characterized in a similar way to Gorsuch's hewing to principle over popular opinion. Pryor played a role when he was Attorney General of Alabama in removing a very popular Supreme Court justice who had placed, I think, like a
Roy
25.
Moore, right?
Yeah, the name Roy Moore had placed a 2,500-pound statue of the Ten Commandments in the state courthouse and was ordered to remove it and defied a court order. Pryor asked a court to remove him and became the target of a lot of evangelical fury over that. So the conservatives I've spoken to said it's very hard to disaggregate sort of the evangelical anger at him over that and their opposition to him on the grounds of this transgender ruling where he sided with the majority.
Yeah, I think this reveals a little bit some of the like conservative intellectual gymnastics that occur on this issue of like judicial activism, where like judicial activism is basically anything that a judge does that they disagree with that flies against either precedent or you know case law or in the liberal argument, the Constitution. And when they do something that is, you know, flies in the face of precedent that conservatives agree with, they applaud it. So this is sort of one of those times when that is brought into stark relief.
I think it's important to keep in mind there's a conservative debate about this. He has a lot of defenders, including soon to be Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Pryor served as his deputy. Sessions, a major booster of his nomination. So it does seem both Hardeman and Pryor have people who are promoting their nominations. And Gorsuch, too, I think he would probably be the most popular nominee among legal and intellectual conservatives. So it will be interesting to see what happens. I think the other aspect that is really interesting about the Supreme Court nomination is that Trump often tells, you know, I think tells small lies that surprise people. He's litigating the crowd size of his inauguration and arguing about what happened with the popular vote. But this is something that conservatives trusted him to keep his word about, and that it does appear he is set to keep his word on. So I think a lot of people say, oh, you can't take his word on anything. He's completely unpredictable. But this is something he's been pretty predictable about, and that he is coming through for in a really important way for, you know, mainstream conservatives and Republicans.
That's a really interesting point. So let's kind of look at this now from the other angle. Like, next Thursday, a week from today, we're going to find out who this nominee is. And then it's going to be all about what's happening in the Senate, you know, which, Nancy, as you've been following, is like waist deep in Trump cabinet appointees and sorting through those nominations. How is this going to be similar, and how is this going to be different when the Supreme Court nomination goes up?
Well, I feel like the Senate Democrats haven't been successful, obviously, in blocking any of the cabinet nominees. And no one really thought they would be. They just thought that they would make a lot of noise in it. But underlying that, I think that the Senate Minority Leader, Chuck Schumer, has always looked ahead to the Supreme Court fight as something that's going to be much more key than these actual cabinet picks. This is something that, particularly if Trump picks someone younger, could be on the court for years and will just influence tons more policy than a cabinet pick would. And so I think that the Senate Democrats, whereas they've been more divided and sort of less able to pick a target to try to bring down a cabinet pick, I think that Chuck Schumer is really going to try to toe the line and make sure that they are much more aligned and much more unified on their message with the SCOTUS pick.
And let's be clear about this. I mean, the rules are different, right? The filibuster is in place as an option for Democrats for the Supreme Court, as it has not been in the cabinet. But Eliana, you were talking earlier about how, you know, the all of these judges have come up for votes in the Senate before, and some of them have passed with pretty, you know, beyond filibuster flying colors.
That's exactly right. All three of these judges, when they were nominated for their circuit court positions by George W. Bush, came up before the Senate. And the only one who was controversial was Bill Pryor, who I believe it was a 53-47 vote. It could have been 52-48. I'm not positive. But the other two were unanimous, came through unanimously. So I think it will be more difficult for Democrats to mount serious opposition to them or make the case that it's different now, though they certainly have done it before. And one of the arguments, I think, in favor of the other two that I've heard people make is that it will be very difficult for Democrats to lay a finger on them. They haven't authored controversial decisions or given speeches where they've made controversial arguments and so on. So I do think those unanimous votes will be used as certainly you'll hear Republicans increasingly talk about them in the run-up to their confirmation hearings.
Mm-hmm. And now the fulcrum between, you know, that slim Republican majority and the 60 to clear a filibuster lies right, you know, it's that swing block of Democratic senators that I think we're probably going to talk about every week on the Nerdcast from now until eternity. It's 10 Democrats from states that Trump won who are up for re-election in 2018. And Ken, there's going to be a big money machine that's going to fire up as soon as this nomination comes down to try and put pressure on them.
Yeah, that's right. And the reason for it is some of the sort of inverse of what we were talking about before, which is, you know, we were saying that this is there are conservatives who, you know, may have been sort of lukewarm on Trump who voted for him because of the Supreme Court. There were liberals who may have been lukewarm on Hillary who voted for her because of the Supreme Court. And there are a ton of donors for whom, major donors, for whom the Supreme Court is sort of the be-all and the end-all. So we will see a lot of spending by Republicans and conservatives to push whoever the pick is, and we will see a lot of spending by liberals and Democrats to oppose whoever the pick is. And I think this will shape up as one of the early 2018 fights, as you alluded to, that there are going to be conservatives who are going to be targeting these red state senators who are up for re-election, and they're going to be looking for places where they can kind of ding them, not as being insufficiently supportive of Trump, but as being like, you know, big liberals who don't represent the characteristics and the constituencies in their state. The other thing that I would say, just on the specifics of it, you know, per Eliana's point that, like, these, it's going to be tough for Democrats to oppose people, Senate Democrats to oppose people who went through in their, you know, lower court nominations without nary a fight. They will oppose them. They'll set all that aside. But it's sort of ironic that the one guy who you would think that Democrats might be more supportive of prior, you know, because of these decisions that we talked about in the 2011 transgender case and because of the actions with Roy Moore, the state Supreme Court justice, you know, that he will, you know, he will still get the same sort of vociferous opposition.
But by the same token, I think the Democrats, who had such a huge issue with having just 8 Supreme Court justices for the past year, will have you know, a much easier time stomaching that over the next couple of months.
Yeah, the trial and all the arguments that were made about you know, about the necessity of having 9 people on the court, about you know, the judges and their sort of previous nominations, those go out the window. Supreme Court fights are like, you know, the become like one of the biggest spectacles in all of politics. And I think even bigger, you know, to your point, Scott, since Citizens United really unleashed some of this big money, you know, it was still legal for, you know, outside groups to spend unlimited funds on, you know, on non-electoral, on issue advocacy, which the court, you know, arguably is, but it's really emboldened some of these big donors to come forth in a major way. And these big donors, like I said, really care about the Supreme Court.
There's a lot more infrastructure set up around this. I think the number to keep track of is $10 million. That's Politico's Burgess Everett reported a few weeks ago that the deep-pocketed Judicial Crisis Network, which is part of the, you know, the Koch network of outside groups, is going to plow at least that much money into advertisements targeting Democratic senators up for re-election in some of these in some of these red states, you know, like Montana, North Dakota, Indiana. These are places that went very hard for Trump in 2016.
And I expect that to be a big subject of conversation this weekend when the Koch, when the Kochs convene their donor network for one of their twice a year seminars in Palm Springs, California. They have had actual Supreme Court justices attend the events around these in the past, and this is something that their donors care a lot about.
Nancy, last word. What do you think we ought to be keeping in mind and looking for as this process develops next week?
Well, I just think it'll be interesting to see, you know, who they end up picking and then just also who that person is close to, because I think, you know, whether or not the pick goes to someone that's close to Sessions or, you know, close to Don McGahn, the White House counsel, it will say something not just about the direction, obviously, of the Trump presidency, but who in the White House and who among his cadre of advisors really has his ear, because this is, you know, one of the most consequential decisions that he's going to make of his whole presidency.
All right. Well, that point about the power dynamics within the Trump administration actually is a great point to segue into our second number, our second data point of this podcast, and that's 3 to 5 million. And that's the number of illegal ballots that President Trump believes were cast by ineligible voters in 2016, as he's been saying for the past few days, including in his first broadcast news interview since he took office. And so, Charlie, I mean, this is potentially the biggest of an enormous number of distractions that were kind of served up in the first week of presidency, when usually we're seeing, you know, a new administration on message, they're pushing their new policy, and yet here we are.
Yeah, it's just a bonkers, crazy claim. Like, 3 to 5 million votes is ridiculous. It's ludicrous, and let's just say that right now. There is no evidence of that whatsoever. And the one thing that I would say is I'm not somebody who easily dismisses the claims of voter fraud, because, you know, one of the things I've learned as, you know, covering politics for 20 years is, like, there's a dirty secret when it comes to the big parties that voters are never told. And the dirty little secret is this. Democrats are willing to tolerate a little voter fraud because if it happens, it tends to work to their advantage. Now, at the same time, Republicans are willing to tolerate a little voter disenfranchisement because if it happens, it tends to work to their advantage. And so I don't automatically dismiss claims of voter fraud, and I think Democrats are far too quick to dismiss them, especially when you look at the history of American elections, whether it's LBJ in Texas in the Senate, whether it's Kennedy in Chicago and Mayor Daley. I mean, even in the modern day, you see examples of it. So let's not deny that it happens, but it does not happen on the scale.
It's the widespread nature.
And it's the idea that 3 to 5 million fraudulent votes were out there. For that many to have been cast, there would have had to have been a concerted national effort in place. People would have gone to jail. It would have been a massive scandal, one of the biggest political scandals in American history, bigger than Watergate, bigger than so many other things. That's a ton of votes. 5 million votes would have put Romney over Obama. It would have put John Kerry over Bush. And clearly, it would have changed the 2000 election as well. And so here's the last point of why it's so ridiculous. If there was such an effort, if Democrats were trying to do it, or if there were some nefarious forces trying to get these folks to vote against Trump, you'd never do it in a state like California because you don't need to. You know, you would be well aware of the implications of the way the Electoral College works. So you would have done it in all the swing states that Donald Trump carried. So it's just a ridiculous thing to fixate on.
Yeah, and now Trump is, I mean, to speak of distractions, he's calling for a major investigation of vote fraud. And so, you know, having been through I cover it as a reporter in Olympia, Washington, the 2004 Washington gubernatorial election, where after the first count, the Republican candidate Dino Rossi led by 261 votes. That triggered a mandatory recount. Rossi finished ahead by 42 votes. And then the Democrats paid for another statewide recount that put Christine Gregoire, the Democrat, up by like 130 votes. That the Republicans sued, and we had a major investigation of all these claims of illegal voting and whatnot, and they put forth specific like ballots that they wanted to rule invalid, and that ended up with a court covering a long trial in Eastern Washington. A lot of driving back and forth over the Cascade Mountains, with the judge ruling that in fact Gregoire won, and actually ruling invalid a couple votes to Rossi. So that this was like a giant investigation, lawsuit, legal case that ended up with the finding like two votes that were actually illegal. So
tell me more about the court case in Washington, Ken.
All right, but it's just a good example. First of all, it's a good example. It's a good example of several things. First of all, that like, you know, when you're counting this many votes, you could count it 100 different times and get 100 different results. And second of all, when you're actually looking for illegal votes, it's like extremely difficult to prove them.
Well, let's zoom out a little bit from this is happening right now, and the president was talking about it yesterday. But this is one of kind of a number of just random distractions that's popped up over the first week of this presidency. He tweeted about sending the feds to Chicago. He attacked CNN on Twitter. He was needling the protesters who were in Washington right after his inauguration. There was the whole thing about the crowd size, the potentially bringing in an applause line to the CIA for his speech there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, Eliana, has this obscured or kind of distracted from some of the big stuff that's actually happened in this first week? I mean, there have been 12 executive orders and presidential memoranda. Congress is starting to get to work. There's a lot going on here.
Yeah, I think I have a somewhat contrarian view of all of this, which is that there's so much focus on that Trump said X or Trump said Y. You know, he's litigating the crowd size. Why is he doing it? Now he's litigating the popular vote. Why is he doing it? And I think that distracts somewhat from the fact that there is a real ideology and point of view that undergirds everything that's happening in the Trump White House. I think you saw that come through in his inaugural address, and I think you're seeing it come through in these executive orders. And the craziness that's out front all the time distracts from how big a political shift is happening in this White House.
Tell us more about that, because this would be the first Republican White House in who knows how long that would not be so much a conservative White House
This is not a Republican White House. I think what we're seeing here is it's really like something of a coalition government where we have a nationalist populist White House that's going to partner with a Republican majority in Congress on some things and partner with Democrats on some other things. You know, the immigration, they'll agree with Republicans in Congress on immigration. They'll butt heads on some of this infrastructure stuff. When Paul Ryan says he wants to privatize Medicaid, no way is Donald Trump and the people in some of the Trump Brexit states, no way are they going to see that happen. And I think Trump aligns much more with Democrats on some things and more with Republicans on other things. But I think it's a mistake to view him through a traditional political lens where, like, we debate between, if you think of it as a football field where the debate happens between the 45-yard lines. I think Trump...
Trump isn't in the stadium.
Trump is
somewhere else.
I think it's more accurate to think of Trump as looking at things, along a horizontal axis where he says, I'm for you people, all of whom are at the bottom of the heap and who are getting screwed by the people at the top of the heap.
Charlie?
I think Eliana makes a really smart point here, which is not to lose sight of this emerging ideology. This is something we haven't seen before, and if he were able to execute it, it would mark a profound change in our politics. Now, having said that, the problem, though, is while you can see the signs of this happening, these distractions are so enormous that it's hard for me to even envision him executing the fine detail that would be necessary to change the model. So for voters who voted for Trump, they are in a way getting that deep change and break with a broken system that they wanted. But at the same time, his focus and his obsession with these ridiculous little points mean that he will never be able to execute that vision. And it's also serving to underscore the worst fears of the opposition and even some of his allies. Like, there was a great quote in Gabe DeBenedetti's story today, which is excellent. If you haven't read it, you should read it, about the Dem scorched earth strategy, where Governor Jay Inslee of Washington State says, essentially, they were entitled to a grace period, and they blew it. It's been worse than I could have imagined, even in the first few days. And the of course, he's a
another
partisan.
Another Washington State shout out.
Exactly. Let me go into some details of... more
Jay
court cases there.
No,
I'm kidding.
It is the Nerdcast. Come on.
I'm kidding. But no, but the larger point here is that if you're going to focus on these, on litigating these points, you're going to lose any momentum and you're not going to be taken seriously. And I think that's what he's in danger of running into right now.
I mean, it's not just that he's distracting and sort of shooting himself in the foot. It's that the type of agenda that Ileana and that you got and that you, Charlie, are talking about is like it's so difficult to bridge these gaps, to like side with Democrats on trade against the Republican orthodoxy and then side with the Republican hardliners on immigration against some in the Republican sort of leadership as well as against Democrats. Like, to thread that needle is just so difficult, and we haven't seen it. We haven't seen it in recent years. What were we seen? Administration sort of get, affect the most change or have the most success is when everyone is reading off the same, is when you have united government, all one side or all the other, and everyone is reading off the same playbook. So Bush, during the early years of Bush, just jamming stuff through with methodical efficiency with the Republican Congress until he lost it in 2006. And then on the flip side, look at Obama. In Obama's first 2 years before he lost full Democratic control, he very much tried to work across party lines and tried to work with his, with the various factions within the Democratic base, and it kind of hindered himself a little bit. On Obamacare took a long time to get through because Obama wanted to work with everyone and bring everyone in. And of course, Ted Kennedy died and they lost a veto-proof majority, majority in the Senate, and then they lost the House in 2010, and he sort of lost the ability to do that. So Trump is starting from a place where he is neither sort of working closely across party lines or within his own party, nor is he just jamming stuff through that sort of fits the Republican orthodoxy. And on top of it, as we just discussed, he's adding all these distractions to the mix. Makes it very difficult to see the sort of pathway for him to rack up a lot of big victories early in his term.
Well, and yet, I mean, he still does. He has those big majorities, especially in the House. The Senate's obviously a smaller majority, but it's potentially, Mitch McConnell is very good at wringing as many votes as he can out of that. Eliana, I mean, to the point that Ken just raised, how, if at all, is the circus that seems to surround Trump wherever he goes including on the internet, affecting relations with congressional Republicans, if at all?
I think it is affecting relations with congressional Republicans. I think there's a view among congressmen and Republican leaders that since Trump is something of a blank slate on policy, that it creates a lot of opportunity for them. I think what they're going to find is that there's a view that they're in control. But the reality is I really don't think that they can control Donald Trump. And because there really is an ideology coming out of the Trump White House, things may be more difficult than they appear. Yes, I think they will have a lot of control on the areas where they align, like repealing Obamacare. Certainly, I think Trump and his folks will leave the detail to Republicans in Congress. We'll leave the details to Republicans in Congress. But I don't think Republicans in Congress are going to necessarily have their way in areas where they butt heads with up the populist ideology. I think the most important shift, and this is where I don't know, and I think it will be interesting to see how the Republican Congress reacts, is that Trump's inaugural was incredibly inward-looking, and I don't think that he has much of a sense of America's role on the world stage. And to the extent he does, I think he thinks that the post-World War II international order that began really with the end of World War II, the Marshall Plan, and so on, has not served America well, and that it's been bad for American citizens, and he wants to retrench from the world stage. That is not the view of either Republicans or Democrats in Congress, and I think he may be the first American president since World War II to see things that way. I'm very interested to see how Republicans in Congress will respond to that.
And we've already seen some signs that there will be opposition. The fact that you had three prominent Republican senators who were talking about voting against the Secretary of State pick, who, by the way, was expressing sentiments on their issues that were a lot closer to the Republican orthodoxy than those of Donald Trump. I'm talking about Tillerson, and I'm talking about Rubio, McCain, and Graham. I mean, they ultimately voted for him, but it's not hard to foresee other places where it would be like a direct contrast, where Trump would be putting something forward or taking a position on foreign policy that is more anathema to them, where they would, stand, maybe not so much Rubio, but certainly McCain and Graham would sort of stand firm and refuse to go along with Trump's sort of new way of, in this case, foreign policy. But you could extend this, I think, to like any number of issues that Republicans care deeply about where Trump is not aligned with them.
Charlie, you're scribbling furiously as Eliana and Ken were talking. What you got?
Yeah, well, Scott, it's mostly that the more I heard from Eliana and Ken, the more I began to think about just the transformative effect that Trump could have on American politics. You know, if he was able to show some discipline and execute this Jacksonian vision that he has, because, I mean, here's what could happen, and you can see some vestiges of this already. He could pry parts of organized labor loose from the Democratic coalition. Think about what that would do to the Democratic Party. He would completely rattle the electoral map across the Rust Belt, change all the assumptions we have about Electoral College locks. And there are so many other implications if he would just show a little more discipline. And that is what's so, I think, alarming about the first week, that on the one hand, you see moves toward creating an entirely new vision of governance. And keep in mind, it is resonating with some Americans. One of the things that I remember from the inauguration is how many pundits and TV commentators and all the network folks and journalists talking about how dark this vision, this dystopian vision that Trump laid out, and how terrible it is. Meanwhile, in the poll that we ran this week with Morning Consult, 49% of Americans, or of voters that we surveyed, said that speech was excellent or good. And he got high marks for the America First angle. People like that. People responded to it. So the point is that if he's serious about implementing this vision, there is a lane for him. We're beginning to see that. But as long as he's focused on all this foolishness, he's going nowhere.
I mean, we just keep on. I feel like it's just it's we've got to disabuse ourselves of this notion that, like, if he could just be so a normal true. Politician if he could just have a little discipline, if he could just step away from Twitter, if he could just stop obsessing over cable news. Like, he's not going to do it. He didn't do it during the campaign when it would have been in his best interest to do it. He didn't do it during the transition when it was in his interest to do it. And we've seen in this first week, he has not done it in the White House.
But here's a question, though, for you guys. Could anyone – okay, so let's just assume he's not he's not emotionally, mentally, constitutionally capable of executing this vision. It will be out there, and someone will try to emulate it. Is there anyone else in American politics who might be able to pull it off? I mean, I can't even think of folks. You know, he's so unique, and he's such an example of lightning in a bottle.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, it's like some of the same things that I just cited as really, and we've just discussed as really hindering him, were also what made him so popular. So you get a more disciplined politician who has some of the same populist ideas, but doesn't have that charisma and that sort of sense of authenticity. They're just not going to appeal to the electorate in the same way.
All right. At this point, let's switch gears from Trump to the party that he's put in exile. And our third data point.
He's disemboweled viciously.
Eviscerated.
Our third data point and final one this week is 11. And that is the setting on the amp right now, Spinal Tap style, for the Democratic Party, which spent the first week of the Donald Trump administration basically in an extended primal scream. I mean, we're talking about the marches on Saturday, which saw a huge turnout, not just in Washington, D.C., but in a bunch of cities around the country. We're seeing Elizabeth Warren, of all people, getting attacked by liberal activists for saying that she's going to vote for Ben Carson to be the Secretary for Housing and Urban Development. We've got the Daily Kos calling for an uprising in primaries. I mean, Charlie, what's happening?
Well, at the risk of sounding a little bit like a management toady, I would point people to Gabe DiBenedetti's story today, which is, you know, the idea that Democrats are embarking on a scorched earth strategy against Donald Trump. It's a great story, and the reason I'm so high on it is because I got to talk to Gabe a lot during the reporting process and the editing process, and in hearing all the things that he heard in seeing those quotes and talking to him about what he wasn't able to get into the story. And it really goes to show that the Democratic Party is becoming very radicalized, not the entire party, but much of it, even beyond where it might have been during the George Bush era and things like that. And they have, after much thought in, you know, private conferences, in conference calls, publicly and privately, they've come. Many of them have come to the point where they believe that there is no way to handle Trump or to deal with Trump. And so in that space, into that void, they believe they have to go with a scorched earth, not now, not ever approach of not even thinking about working with him. And the one thing, the best example of that came last week in the Democratic National Committee Candidates Forum, where one of the questions was, how will you work with the new president and will you look for opportunities? And one of the candidates, a veteran politician, New Hampshire State Party Chairman Ray Buckley, laughed at it and said, that is an absolutely ridiculous question. And so the field of candidates universally agreed that it's absolutely ludicrous to even consider the idea of working with Trump.
The only point I have to make on this data point is that watching these marches all over the country, oversubscribed, some of them had to be canceled because way too many people were showing up, was, isn't this what Hillary Clinton was trying to do her entire campaign? Like, get an outpouring of enthusiasm based around some sort of women's issue, enthusiasm around, you know, girl power. And, like, it happened spontaneously if you just take Hillary Clinton out of the equation.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's a lot easier. One of the lessons there is, like, it's just so much easier to rally and mobilize at the grassroots level and at every level, really, of politics up through the major donors in the opposition. It's so much easier to rally against something than it is to rally for something. And, you know, there's a lot of energy out there, and Democrats are having this debate about how to harness it. It happens as Democrats are debating sort of the future of their party and what their vision is going to be for their party going forward. And, you know, I think the energy is on the populist side, and the Daily Kos thing about, you know, calling for a revolt does sort of feed into this idea that, like, Democrats are at this moment right now where they have this energy, and if they're not careful, this energy will like blow up the party like the Tea Party did with Republicans in 2009.
Well, it, you know, it's really interesting. You mentioned bottling it specifically as kind of a metaphor I've been thinking about a lot. With and, you know, we saw Emily's List and other Democratic groups holding candidate trainings and gathering as many emails as they possibly could while all these women were in D.C. for this march last weekend, and maybe hoping that they can kind of keep some of this energy, which is very unusual for this point, so soon after an election, and unleash it again at a later date. CNN reported this week that the DCCC, the House Democratic Campaign Committee, has grown its donor list by 500,000 people already in 2017, which is a bonkers big number. But you know, as you said, there's only so much of this you can contain, right? And if there's a seeming separation and priorities of the grassroots and the Democrats in elected office. Again, as we mention all the time, many of whom in the Senate are going to be running in very conservative states for re-election in 2018, you can see the beginnings of a big problem here within the party. Right, Charlie?
Yeah, I mean, I think the real danger here of this kind of approach is, number one, the blowback on the Senate candidates. 10 of them are running in states that Trump carried, and that's important to remember. 10 are running in those circumstances. And if they overplay their hand, and if Americans are kind of okay with Trump and his numbers either stay where they're at now or maybe even rise a little bit, all of a sudden you have to worry about blowback to candidates up and down the ballot on 2018. And just as important, think about how this approach could shape the 2020 presidential candidate or presidential race, because all of a sudden a seething party base is going to incentivize all the ambitious presidential candidates to outdo each other in their level of vitriol towards Donald Trump. And so all of that ripples out of this decision now to go with a not now, not ever approach toward Donald Trump.
And what you're talking about, Charlie, in 2020, the temptation of Democratic candidates to be as liberal as they can, as sort of the backlash against Trump, in many ways is the challenge for the opposite challenge for the Democrats running for re-election, as you talked about in 2018. You know, you're talking about, well, they might face blowback in the general election if they're too liberal. If they're not liberal enough, they may face a primary challenge, like a real primary challenge. That's the Tea Party conundrum, and that's sort of what we're getting Daily Kos and the suggestion that, like, Democrats are need to be, that there's almost like a litmus test for 100% complete opposition to Trump and adhering to, you know, really liberal values and causes that, if they're insufficiently, if they're not seen as doing that, that they could face primary challenges from an energized base in 2018 before they even get to a general.
I agree with all that, but I would just clarify, my point only refers to their posture towards Trump. I'm not even talking about ideology. I'm just saying, you know, their political futures will be contingent in some ways, or could be, based on their posture toward Donald Trump.
Well, so here's something I'm wondering. Ken, you brought up the Tea Party, which is kind of a historical precedent for this kind of a party out of power relying on the energy of a burgeoning mass movement to re-energize itself, remake itself, get back into power. But, you know, it's not this is not the only mass protest that we've seen. And I'm wondering, I mean, there's also a potential parallel here to Wisconsin in 2011, right, Eliana? I mean, we saw huge Democratic protests against Governor Scott Walker there. And, you know, I don't want to spoil the ending for you, but Scott Walker is still the governor. So
I think the other thing that you saw in Wisconsin that it will be interesting to see how it plays out now is huge Republican support for Scott
That's
Walker.
That's a great point.
Enormous cash infusion on his behalf. I had a donor tell me that I think maybe he sent $100,000 to Scott Walker in that race and got death threats, and it did not
this
deter him.
This for a recall in 2012?
Yeah, and he continues to host Walker at his home. The dynamics are a little bit different now, but I think, you know, on the campaign trail, we talked a lot about the tremendous amount of enthusiasm that Trump had on his behalf that did not parallel the enthusiasm of Hillary Clinton supporters. Now it may be that they match each other, but I don't think it can be understated or underestimated how fiercely some of these people back Trump, support Trump, because he is an outsider.
And you know, there's sort of, that's a spectrum of like the Tea Party being like this, like totally, you know, uncontrollable in some ways movement that Republicans were trying to harness to the Wisconsin protests from Democrats were like very much controlled by the state party and even the National Democratic Party. And then there's sort of like the in between parts of it. What Democrats really, I think, have to worry about, they need to be tapping into this energy. And the concern is maybe a different precedent, Occupy Wall Street, which had a ton of energy around it and then just fizzled out because there wasn't the infrastructure there to harness it. And so you see a competition going on right now on this sort of institutional left outside of the Democratic Party among some of these groups and players to emerge as like the vehicle to harness either the grassroots energy or, you know, between, say, like a Move On and an Emily's List and, you know, some of these other groups that were involved in the Women's March. And then on the donor front as well, I mean, David Brock, the former, former right-wing hitman turned Clinton enforcer, held a big conference of his major donors in Florida over inauguration weekend. And he is trying to position himself as sort of like the leading institutional, mass media or opposition research foil to Donald Trump. And there's a lot of pushback from folks who are saying, no, he's too associated with the old Clinton brand, or he's just sort of an opportunist. And then there are others, you know, including the Democracy Alliance and the CAP, Center for American Progress, that are also positioning themselves. And I think we're going to see a real fight, just like we're seeing a fight at the top of the DNC for the chairmanship, that's a little bit about tactics and maybe a lot about vision, or maybe, you know, on the big money front, it'll be more about tactics and less about like ideology, and on the grassroots front as well. I think at every level of the left right now, we're seeing a battle for supremacy as well as about vision.
Charlie, tell us a little bit about how this atmosphere is affecting the race to be the next chair of the Democratic National Committee, which, you know, on the one hand, it's this party figurehead position. On the other hand, it's hard to think of a contest that could be like more divorced from a mass movement than this vote of party apparatchiks and party insiders for, you know, who's going to get the keys to the building for the next few years.
Yeah, the dynamics of the DNC chair race are pretty fascinating, at least to me, for probably a different reason. It's than the characters themselves. I mean, you've got seven candidates running there. Many of them are very credentialed. I've met some of them, and, you know, we've reported a great deal about a bunch of them. And then, you know, in large part, they're an impressive crew. But having said that, you know, now I would say this is the drop that the anvil part. You know, the party just suffered a soul-crushing defeat that raised questions about the existence of the party and what it will look like going forward. They lost at every level. They were exposed to be hollow at the core outside of the beltway of Washington. Yet that DNC chair fight or chair race is a pillow fight. They are playing patty cakes. They agree on everything. No one has put out a cutting edge agenda in any way. There are no new ideas. It is sort of a Me Too crew. Nobody is saying anything. Everybody is afraid to talk about the fissures that grip the party, and it tells you something about the brittle nature of that party right now. They are afraid to allow the Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton split to get aired and discussed. They're afraid that's going to come out and burn the party up. They are afraid to talk about the other dilemma that they face, which is the idea of what does the future look like? Is it the pursuit of the Obama coalition the way we thought it was, or have we discovered from 2016 that that is something of a mirage without Barack Obama at the top of the ticket and too far away for us to bet the party's future on? So there's lots of fissures in that party. And are they really talking about it? I don't think so.
Eliana, you brought up something really interesting earlier that I think speaks to this argument about the future of the coalition. And Republicans, everything's in balance, right? The Democratic coalition ends up being the opposite of what the Republican coalition is, and vice versa, just kind of by the nature of the two-party system.
Yep.
But even as Republican senators and Donald Trump rolled to victory in all the same states and lost all the same states in 2016, the way they got to those wins was very different and potentially speaks to how these coalitions are going to sort themselves out in the future.
Well, one of the interesting things I think we saw in this election was a sort of inversion of the coalitions, where you had blue collar, you know, union types coming into the Republican Party, and white collar types who had voted Republican for decades, really, going into the Democratic Party. I think Hillary Clinton was an embodiment of that, and Trump, even though he's a billionaire, became sort of a, you know, union workers rallied around him in many states. You know, in Ohio, Rob Portman, who also is, you know, an Ivy League graduate. I think he's a University of Michigan Law School graduate, but a graduate of Dartmouth. He had four unions endorse him over his opponent in that race, Ted Strickland, who had previously, when he ran for governor, gotten the endorsement of those unions. So, you know, that I always pointed to as sort of that. I think Ohio showed what could happen if these trends continue. And there was a poll that came out that showed the stronger a voter identified as a Republican, the more anti-trade that voter was. That's a huge political shift underway, and I think shows that some longtime Democratic voters, you know, pulled the lever for Donald Trump this election.
All right, that's all for us. Thanks for coming out this week, Ken Vogel.
Fun time as always.
Charlie Mutessian.
Thanks, Scott.
Nancy Cook.
Thanks for having me.
And Eliana Johnson.
Thank you.
And thank you to all of our listeners. Again, please remember, send in your questions if you have one to nerdcast@politico.com. And we want to be, you know, answering them on air as often as possible. That's nerdcast@politico.com. Also, thank you to our executive producer, Bridget Mulcahy, our illustrator, Bill Cookman, and Nerdcast researcher and Politico producer, Zach Montalaro. And one last thing before we end here. If you made it all the way to the end of this podcast, I'm guessing you probably enjoyed it. So if you wouldn't mind subscribing, rating us, even giving us a written review on iTunes or your favorite podcast app, and sharing this episode on social media, that would be great. Thank you very much. See you next week.